Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. This is episode 289 of the Divine Intervention Podcast. And in this podcast, I'm going to be talking about an important topic. This is a topic that shows up on step one, on step two CK, and on step three. And the topic is going to be alcoholism and the USMLEs, right? Maybe like, Divine, are you trying to teach us how to be alcoholics? No, that's certainly not my goal here. But I just want to discuss alcoholism in the context of every possible way, for the most part, that it can show up on a step one exam, on a step two CK exam, on a step three exam. You'd be surprised at how many questions on each USMLE comes from alcohol. It can come from a biochem perspective. It can come from a clinical perspective. It can come from a SQLI perspective. So we'll hit all those things. And then at the very end, I will talk about the comprehensive step two CK course that I've been advertising for a while. So the thing is, so alcohol, right? We all know what alcohol is. Alcohol is ethanol, right? You know, people drink a ton. And, you know, for many different reasons, I'm not going to judge anyone here. But basically, right, like, you know, people get, you know, people drink alcohol for many different reasons. And when you consume alcohol, you know, it can have a lot of deleterious effects in the body. And, you know, in general, for purposes of MBM exams, you want to know that if a person has alcohol withdrawal, you have to treat it. Alcohol withdrawal is fatal, right? They can go into delirium tremens. They can have all these visual hallucinations that you've probably heard of as alcoholic hallucinosis. So for those people, you usually want to give them a benzodiazepine, right? And if you even want to give like a long-acting, like prophylactic benzo, you want to use something like chlordiazepoxide. Chlordiazepoxide is what's known as Librium. It's a long-acting benzodiazepine that can be used to prevent the sequelae of alcohol withdrawal, right? And classically on MBM exams, when they give you alcohol withdrawal questions, be a person that after surgery, they start having visual hallucinations, they start acting weird, they start having seizures, right? And it's usually like going to be surgery that they had to have because they were in some kind of trauma or accident. Obviously, the thing that put them in the trauma or accident in the first place was that they were drunk, right? So that's the way that usually presents. And then remember, if a person has alcohol use disorder on MBMEs, you want to consider, you know, putting them on naltrexone or acamprosate. Those are the classic drugs that are used on MBMEs to treat alcohol use disorder. And, you know, you should also recommend that those people get into Alcoholics Anonymous. So the thing is, alcohol. So how does alcohol work? So really, like this podcast, again, I want to take it from a pathophysiology all the way to clinical presentations and all those things. Because, again, it's just something I want that if a person that's taking step one listens to, they'll get all the alcoholism questions right. If a person is taking step two CK, step three is listening to this, they'll get all the alcoholism questions right. You should expect a few alcohol-related questions on your exam, right? So let's look at it from a metabolic perspective first, right? So the thing is, where do, you know, after a person drinks alcohol, what happens to it? Well, the thing is, alcohol is actually reabsorbed in the stomach and in the small intestine, especially in the duodenum, right? So many people for some reason think that the stomach has no ability to reabsorb certain things. That is just not true, right? The stomach is actually able to reabsorb not just alcohol, right? But it can absorb some other things. But alcohol is reabsorbed not just in the stomach, but also like in the small intestine. And one thing that happens after it's been reabsorbed is that it then goes to the liver to be metabolized, right? If you remember from studying this, right, that first, you know, alcohol dehydrogenase worked on the alcohol and converted to acetaldehyde. And then acetaldehyde dehydrogenase would then act on that acetaldehyde and convert it to acetic acid, right? So those are the two big enzymes. And then there are also some liver cytochrome enzymes like CYP2E1. That's especially useful for those studying for step one that metabolize alcohol. And remember that alcohol has zero order elimination, right? Remember, there are three things in general. that have zero their elimination, you need to know for NBM exams, right? Phenytoin is one of them. Ethanol or alcohol is another, and then aspirin, right? So remember the P mnemonic, P-E-A, right? So phenytoin, ethanol, and alcohol, right? So you get rid of a fixed amount per unit of time, right? Not a fixed fraction per unit of time. That's an important distinction to keep at the back of your mind, right? So the liver does a lot of metabolism of alcohol. But again, even the stomach, the thing is the stomach actually plays a huge role. As you'll see when we get to talking about Wernicke-Korsakoff syndrome, the stomach also plays a huge role in the metabolism of alcohol, right? And the thing is, it's not just in the liver. You don't just find alcohol dehydrogenase only in the liver. You can also find alcohol dehydrogenase in the stomach, right? And the thing is, in women in general, they tend to have very low levels of alcohol dehydrogenase in their gastric lining, right? So because they have lower levels of alcohol dehydrogenase, they reabsorb a lot of just straight up alcohol they just consumed. That is why if a man drinks a certain amount of alcohol and a woman drinks the exact same amount of alcohol, the woman will in general have higher levels of alcohol, like just straight up alcohol in her blood compared to the man, right? And remember, in general, women just generally have like a lower blood volume, right? Or, you know, you can see like all the fluids in their body is just less somewhat than men, right? So that alcohol is being distributed over a smaller amount of fluid. So it's just a lot more concentrated, right? So again, this is precisely why women, they tend to have higher blood alcohol levels for the same level of alcohol consumed compared to men, right? So this is particularly why, again, women, they can have a lot of really bad sequelae from alcoholism, because it's almost like alcohol has like an increased bioavailability. I guess if we really wanted to summarize this and make it pretty easy to remember, essentially, women have a higher bioavailability of alcohol compared to men, right? Women have a higher bioavailability of alcohol compared to men, right? So again, very high yield to know the enzymes that metabolize alcohol and know this men versus women differences, right? So what are some things that happen with alcoholism from a biochemical perspective? Well, if you really think about it, alcohol dehydrogenase, right, and acetaldehyde dehydrogenase, because these are dehydrogenase enzymes, these enzymes lead to the formation of a lot of NADH, right? They lead to the formation of NADH. So that means any reaction that uses NADH as a reactant is going to work better, right? So what are some examples of those reactions? Well, the first one is going from pyruvate to lactate, right? Because remember, normally in glycolysis, that pyruvate to lactate step happens at the end so that you can regenerate NAD plus for that glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate dehydrogenase step in glycolysis, so you can keep going. So when a person is a big time alcoholic, in going from pyruvate to lactate, you convert NADH to NAD. So that's why lactic acid builds up in people that are alcoholic, right? So again, they can give you a question about like some chronic alcoholic or a person that's acutely intoxicated and give you a bunch of acid-base values. You want to pick the one where their bicarb is low, right? Because alcoholics, they tend to have like a big time lactic acidosis, right? And then also going from acetoacetate to beta hydroxybutyrate, that's also done by that reaction also makes NADH get converted to NAD, right? So again, alcoholics, they tend to have high levels of beta hydroxybutyrate, which again is an example of a ketone body, right? So it shouldn't come to you as a surprise that alcoholics, they tend to have a ketoacidosis as well, right? And then the thing is, if you remember from glycolysis, right? So, you know, you have fructose to fructose, 1,6 bisphosphate, and then that fructose 1,6 bisphosphate is split by aldolase, at least one of its isoforms, right? And then you form dihydroxyacetone phosphate. Well, the thing is that dihydroxyacetone phosphate can be converted to glycerol 3-phosphate, right? Again, and in this reaction, NADH is also converted to NAD. Again, remember, alcoholics, they have high levels of NADH. And the thing is, For those of you that are taking step 2, CK step 3, I know this basic science part may be boring you a bit, but the thing is, if you understand it, it'll make the step 2, CK step 3 stuff just like extremely easy. Like, it won't seem like I'm trying to force you to memorize something. That's the thing I always tell people. One of the best ways of learning, even as a resident, even as a senior med student, like a third, fourth year, is just to understand pathophysiology. If you understand pathophysiology, you can see clinical problems for what they are and solve them just a lot more prudently. But anyhow, right, so this glycerol 3-phosphate that's made from DHAP, right, dihydroxyacetone phosphate, you can actually use it to make triglycerides. Remember, triglycerides, right, literally contain glycerol and 3-free fatty acids, right? So glycerol 3-phosphate, right, it leads to the formation of fatty acids, right? So this is one of the reasons why alcoholics, they tend to get hepatic steatosis, right? They get a lot of fatty liver. Because again, just all that, any, like, really many of the metabolic things you see in alcoholism, you can trace it back to having elevated levels of NADH, right? Elevated levels of NADH. So again, that's really high you to know, right? So again, alcoholics, they'll have a low bicarb, they'll have a high anion gap metabolic acidosis, right? And remember, I said that, alcohol dehydrogenase converts alcohol to acetaldehyde. Remember, alcohol dehydrogenase is actually the rate-limiting enzyme of alcohol metabolism, right? And then that acetaldehyde dehydrogenase, right, converts acetaldehyde to acetic acid or acetate or whatever, right? Guess what? That acetate, you know what? It can actually be converted down the line to acetyl-CoA, right? It can be converted to acetyl-CoA. And again, remember, acetyl-CoA is one of those big feedstocks that are necessary for the synthesis of triglycerides, right? So again, that also explains why people that are alcoholics, right, again, they tend to have high levels of fat in their liver. They tend to have a lot of fatty liver, right? So, and this pyruvate that is being converted to lactate, you can already begin to see that, because if you think back to gluconeogenesis, pyruvate is actually one of the key agents used in gluconeogenesis, right? Remember, like, pyruvate to oxaloacetate, and then oxaloacetate being converted to phosphoenolpyruvate, right? So the thing is, when people are alcoholics, right, again, they're depleting their pyruvate, they're putting all in lactic acid. And as they keep putting it all in lactic acid, right, there's less pyruvate available. And that pyruvate that is not available, they are not going to be able to do gluconeogenesis, right? So people that have alcoholism, they tend to be hypoglycemic, right? They tend to be hypoglycemic. It's very important to know that they tend to be hypoglycemic. And one thing that they love to test on NBMEs are, like, okay, what are some labs you may find in a person that's an alcoholic? Well, the thing is, people that are alcoholics, remember, they tend to have this AST to ALT ratio that's usually greater than 2:1, right? Although, to be honest with you, I would not stick with that hard and fast rule on NBMEs. As long as the AST is appreciably higher than the ALT, even if it's not in a 2:1 ratio, the person is likely an alcoholic of some sort, right? And again, you may wonder, okay, Divine, why is the AST much higher than the ALT? Well, it makes sense. The thing is, alcohol is directly toxic to the mitochondria, right? So it basically destroys the mitochondria. So when you destroy the mitochondria, you can already begin to see that there will potentially be some problems, right? Like, one, you're going to have a lot of issues with ATP production. And then two, that cell soup, all those enzymes that you find in the mitochondria are going to be released, right? Like AST, aspartate transaminase, is actually a mitochondrial enzyme, right? So when the mitochondria is destroyed, all its contents will leak out into the bloodstream, right? And that's going to cause an increase in AST, right? You're just basically like releasing AST from the bag of AST, which in this case is the mitochondria, right? And the thing is, if you remember, whenever a person has a lot of lipid metabolism going on, they need a ton of smooth endoplasmic reticulum to make that happen, right? This is something you probably learned in cell biology in your first year or something like that, right? If you're dealing with lipid metabolism, you need a lot of smooth endoplasmic reticulum, right? So the thing is, again, I already talked about how people that are alcoholics, they have high NADH. And because of that high NADH, they have a lot of glycerol 3-phosphate. So because they have a lot of glycerol 3-phosphate, they are making a ton of lipid, right? All that lipid metabolism, you need smooth endoplasmic reticulum to make that happen, right? Well, for all that smooth endoplasmic reticulum to come on board, you basically need to make a ton of them, right? So you need to make a ton of them. So people that have that are big time alcoholics, they actually have, again, they can easily make this a cell biology question on step one. They have a higher number of smooth endoplasmic reticulum, like in their hepatocytes and things like that. And the thing is, one enzyme that is very useful in the smooth endoplasmic reticulum is gamma glutamyl transferase, GGT, right? So as you're making more smooth endoplasmic reticulum, you should have a commensurate increase in your GGT levels. So this is why an increase in GGT is a relatively specific finding on MBM exams in alcoholism, right? So that's actually high yield to know for exams. Although GGT is not just elevated for those reasons, right? GGT is also elevated when a person has obstructive liver disease of some sort, right? So many times they'll give you these questions on MBMEs where the ALK force is elevated and the GGT is elevated. That localizes the ALK force elevation to an obstructive liver disease. But if you notice that, wow, the ALK force is elevated, but the GGT is normal, then that ALK force elevation is almost invariably going to be from metabolic bone disease on an MBM exam. So again, that's one way they can integrate those things on tests. And then remember, people that are alcoholics, they also tend to have a pretty high incidence of like gout, right? Or even nephrolithiasis. So you may wonder why. Again, all this lactic acid, all this beta hydroxybutyric acid that's increasing because they have high levels of NADH. Well, those things, the body is going to try to get rid of them, right? It's going to use a transporter to try to get rid of these things. Only problem is those transporters that your body uses to get rid of lactic acid, to get rid of beta hydroxybutyric acid, those are the same transporters that are used to get rid of uric acid, right? So there's more competition. Right. So if there's more competition, you have less excretion of uric acid, right? You'll be like an under excretor of uric acid. So that's going to cause hyperuricemia, and that can increase the person's risk of gout, right? That can increase the person's risk of gout. And again, if you have a ton of uric acid, again, that could potentially lead to crystalline nephropathy, right? Like uric acid stones, right? So what are some other ways your friends at the MBME can go after alcoholism? Well, the thing is, alcoholism can cause many problems, right? It can cause like a megaloblastic anemia, right? Because the thing is, alcohol directly inhibits the reabsorption of folate in the gut, right? In fact, many people that are alcoholics, they tend to have big time folate deficiency, right? Because again, there's an enzyme that helps you reabsorb folate in the GI tract. That enzyme is directly inhibited by alcohol, right? So people that have alcoholism, they'll have low folate because they're not reabsorbing adequate amounts of it. And if you're not reabsorbing adequate amounts of it, they're going to have a lot of problems with DNA synthesis, right? So because they have DNA synthesis problems, they'll have a megaloblastic anemia. So the MCV will be greater than 100 on MBM exams, right? And then many times, right, they can give you a question on MBMEs about an alcoholic that was found down, right? And then they'll say that, oh, emergent EMS brings the alcoholic to the hospital and this alcoholic has like red urine and elevated creatinine. Well, you want to think about rhabdomyolysis, right? So remember, again, you drink a ton, right? You pass out for like 18, 24 hours, whatever, however long it takes. The thing is, when your muscles are not being used, right, they're going to be destroyed. They're going to start breaking down. And alcohol is also, again, directly toxic to muscle. So that myoglobin is going to be released into the circulation. It's going to go torch the person's kidneys, cause an acute tubular necrosis, right? So they'll have like an acute kidney injury. They'll basically have an intrarenal acute kidney injury, right? And as you'll see, right, those people's urine will be red. And again, when you do your analysis, you'll see a ton of blood. It'll be like 3+, 4+ blood. But then you do urine microscopy and you don't see any red blood cells. That tells you that you're dealing with myoglobin, right? And then remember, alcohol in and of itself, right? As I said, it's metabolized by this cytochrome P450 system, right? Like, like CYP2E1, for example. In fact, I think I may have mentioned this in prior podcasts before. Remember, alcoholism can actually modulate the cytochrome P450 system, right? If a person is a chronic alcoholic, their cytochrome P450 system will be revved up, right? So they can give you a question about a person that gets pregnant on while taking OCPs that's an alcoholic. Well, that's what happened. She took a ton of alcohol, you know, big time alcoholic. Whenever you're a chronic alcoholic, CYP450 is revved up, right? Because again, you got to metabolize the alcohol somehow, right? It can't just chill in your body, right? So as that CYP450 is being metabolized, as the alcohol is being metabolized by CYP450, your CYP450 is revved up. So you're going to start metabolizing other drugs very quickly, like OCPs, for example. So the person can get pregnant. But remember, when a person acutely drinks a large amount of alcohol, right? When you drink a very large amount of alcohol, that actually causes an inhibition of the cytochrome P450 system, right? So the P450 system is inhibited when a person is acutely alcoholic. The P450 system is revved up when a person is a chronic alcoholic, right? So going back to this whole liver business, right? So because if a person is a chronic alcoholic, who drinks a ton of alcohol, right, over time, and your CYP450 system is revved up, whenever a person has like a heme pathway problem, that's gonna be exacerbated by consuming alcohol, right? Because those heme pathway problems, the last thing you want to do is to cause more flux through the heme pathway, right? So the disorders I'm talking about here are things like porphyria cutanea tarda, or which is a urate deficiency, right? Uroporphyrinogen decarboxylase, or acute intermittent porphyria, peanut butter and jelly deaminase, right? So PUFO bilinogen deaminase deficiency, right? So if you increase flux through those pathways, those porphyrins will begin to accumulate, and the person will start having like an exacerbation of symptoms, right? So again, whenever you give any CYP450 activator, like alcohol, right, or you know, things like barbiturates or graziofulvin, carbamazepine, phenytoin, rifampin, St. John's wort. So that could be a herbal supplement question. You can always exacerbate a person's symptoms of porphyria cutanea tarda or acute intermittent porphyria, right? So that's why that's why alcoholism is not great. And I think one thing I forgot to mention when I was mentioning the alcoholic enzymes, right? Remember this drug, disulfiram, right? I think the trade name is Antabuse. It inhibits acetaldehyde dehydrogenase. It's a drug that you can use for people that are very motivated to, you know, stop drinking, right? Because when you inhibit acetaldehyde dehydrogenase, you're going to have very high levels of acetaldehyde. You're going to have a very serious hangover, ton of vomiting, stuff like that. But again, on NBMEs though, your first line agents that you want to use to treat alcohol use disorder are things like naltrexone and ecamprosate, and don't forget the disulfiram side effect, right? So like if a person is being treated for like Gardnerella vaginalis, so like bacterial vaginosis or Giardia or Entamoeba histolytica, right, stuff like that, right? Again, if you're taking metronidazole has the ability to inhibit acetaldehyde dehydrogenase, right? That's why people can have this disulfiram effect with taking metronidazole, Flagyl basically, right? So you need to be careful in that regard. Again, you can just see the different ways they can integrate alcoholism on NBMEs, right? So just something you want to be mindful of, right? So we've talked about, again, how alcoholics can get folate deficiency and get a megaloblastic anemia as a result of that, right? Remember, in folate deficiency, your homocysteine levels will be elevated, but your methylmalonic acid levels will be normal, right? And the thing is, alcoholism can cause infertility, right? That's a classic thing they test on NBM exams. They'll talk about a person that's having trouble, you know, having an erection, having trouble procreating with their spouses, right? And alcoholism is the cause, right? Because especially in men, alcohol actually makes the test, like, again, alcohol is a cytotoxic agent, basically. Because if you really think about it, right, you probably remember some of this stuff from, I don't know, like your first year or whatever, how when the mitochondria is porous, when it's destroyed, certain agents are released from it that trigger apoptosis, right? We know that alcohol is a mitochondrial toxin, right? So if you damage mitochondria, that's going to be a problem, It's just simple as that, right? That's going to be a huge problem. So the thing is, many times, if a person keeps taking alcohol over time, especially cells that have a lot of mitochondria, that have a lot of the, you know, very dangerous stuff that can be released that can trigger apoptosis. When a person is an alcoholic, over time, cells will begin to die. They just, like, cells can begin to die in the testicles, right? That's why people that are big time alcoholics, they tend to have very small testicles, right? And if you have small testicles, because you've killed off many of the cells in there, you're not going to be making as much testosterone. Testosterone is the primary controller of libido, is the primary controller of sex drive, right? And you're also not going to be making adequate amounts of sperm if you're a big time alcoholic, right? And obviously there's this whole thing with fetal alcohol syndrome, right? Remember, the key thing there is the philtrum, right? Is the philtrum. They will have some kind of philtrum anomaly, right? Because the NBME, they do this party trick where they will mix and match all these findings you see in other genetic disorders, and then they'll throw in philtrum there. Basically, if you ever see any NBME question and the philtrum is abnormal, it's going to be fetal alcohol syndrome, right? So they can call it like a smooth philtrum, they can call it an indistinct philtrum, they can call it a barely perceptible philtrum. Basically, if you see any philtral abnormality, right, that's going to be fetal alcohol syndrome, right? I remember those kids, they tend to have intellectual disability, they tend to have all these cardiac defects, especially VSDs, right? If you see like a cardiac defect question in a fetal alcohol syndrome, always speak VSD. That's kind of like the big one there, right? And then if you're looking at like the esophagus, for example, right, people that have alcoholism, they can have like Mallory-Weiss tear. Although remember, people that have Mallory-Weiss tear, they'll just have like blood in the stuff they expectorate, in the stuff they cough up, but they will not be hemodynamically unstable. They will not have the subcutaneous emphysema or anything like that, right? Because obviously, if a person is hemodynamically unstable, or they have high fevers, or they appear toxic, or you see the subcutaneous emphysema, or you see like pneumomediastinum, or pneumopericardium, right? Then you're beginning to worry about those people potentially rupturing their esophagus. In that case, right, that's Bear-Half syndrome, right? Bear-Half syndrome. Remember, if you ever suspect that the esophagus has ruptured and they're asking you for a diagnostic test on your exam, remember, you don't want to use barium. You want to use gastrographin, right? Remember, another name for gastrographin on NBMEs is water-soluble contrastor enema, right? And again, alcoholism, again, if a person has hepatic steatosis over time, again, from these elevated levels of NADH leading to increased synthesis of glycerol 3-phosphate, then over time, the person's liver can begin to fail, right? And if the person's liver fails, they can develop portal hypertension, right? And that can cause esophageal varices, right? And esophageal varices, again, it's a huge problem, right? It's a huge problem. And again, with all these direct toxic effects of alcohol on cells, right, it can damage the acinar cells that make up like your pancreas, your pancreatic ducts. So you can begin to release all these pancreatic enzymes prematurely and then destroy the pancreas, right? That's how people get acute pancreatitis. That's how people get chronic pancreatitis. Remember, chronic pancreatitis on imaging, you'll notice that these people's pancreases, they are all they're all calcified, right? So they have like a calcified pancreas. I mean, essentially that pancreas is dead. And if that pancreas is dead, again, that's going to be a huge problem, right? Because you're not going to be able to make insulin, right? So those people are going to be automatic diabetics. But then in addition to being a diabetic, they're also not making pancreatic enzymes, right? So those people are going to have malabsorption, especially like a fat malabsorption. They're going to have like oily stools. They're going to have floating stools, right? So for those people, usually on NBMEs, you'd have to give them pancrelipes, right? Pancrelipes. You need to give them pancrelipes on NBME exams, right? If a person has chronic pancreatitis, please don't pick the answer that involves resecting the pancreas. I can almost guarantee you get the question wrong, right? And remember that alcoholism, like alcohol, has like an additive effect on many malignancies, right? On many malignancies, especially like squamous cell cancers of like the esophagus, of the oral tract, of the, you know, pharyngeal tract and all those things, right? So just stuff to be aware of with alcoholism, right? Again, alcohol, mitochondrial, I think there are just some key things I've kind of hit on today. Again, I'm not done with this podcast, sorry. I want this, again, to be really comprehensive to alcohol. I want you to listen to this podcast, and after you listen to this, any alcohol question you see, you'll just be like an auto-click question, hopefully, for you on the exam. Again, big theme I think I've discussed a lot of today is alcohol is a mitochondrial toxin. If you damage the mitochondria, you'll release things that cause cells to undergo apoptosis, right? That's a pathway. Maybe I'll talk about it like in a future podcast, but I don't want to go down that road right now because I have quite a bit I still need to discuss, right? So again, if cells begin to undergo apoptosis, you begin to lose cells that, again, especially that have a lot of mitochondria. Because a cell that has a lot of mitochondria, if it's exposed to a big-time mitochondrial toxin like alcohol, then that cell is more predisposed to apoptosis. So what are the cells that have a lot of mitochondria in the body? Well, the cells in your cerebellum, right? So as they begin to die, as the person begins to lose the Purkinje cells, right? They have like atrophy of the cerebellum. Or your cerebral cortex, again, as those cells begin to die, right? The cerebral cortex gets smaller and smaller, right? Gets smaller and smaller. So that's why people that are alcoholics, they tend to have a very like cerebral atrophy, right? And again, whenever you have cerebral atrophy, you can already begin to see that it's almost like your skull is not like your skull gets smaller. Your skull is a box, right? It's a bone. So the thing is, that skull, if you have a smaller brain inside it, then that brain begins to dance around in the person's skull. If that brain begins to dance around in the person's skull, you begin to have a shearing of your bridging veins, right? That's why subdural hematomas. So if you get a question about an alcoholic where they notice that, man, over the last 2 weeks, this person has become more somnolent, not very responsive, has signs of increased intracranial pressure. You want to think about a subdural hematoma, right? Shearing of those bridging veins, that's a very common finding in people that are alcoholics. Just again, the pathophys make sense. They have cerebral atrophy, right? So they have a smaller brain dancing around in a fixed size box, aka the skull, right? So they can shear those bridging veins and get a subdural. They can get a subdural hematoma, right? They can get a subdural hematoma. Now, to, I guess, maybe wrap up our conversation today, the thing I'm really going to hit on from an alcohol perspective is Wernicke-Korsakoff. This is one of those things you can almost guarantee you're going to see in some way, shape, or form on your exam, right? On your exam. So what is this whole deal with Wernicke-Korsakoff syndrome? The deal with Wernicke-Korsakoff syndrome is these people get it because of a thiamine deficiency, right? These people get it because of a thiamine deficiency, right? Remember, thiamine is vitamin B1, right? And Wernicke-Korsakoff syndrome, right? I mean, Wernicke's, you probably should separate this. And again, I'll talk pathophysiology in a bit, right? So you need to understand, okay, what are the findings in Wernicke's? Well, it's a triad, right? So the triad is confusion, right? The other second part of the triad is ophthalmoplegia. So the ophthalmoplegia can be like a person having nystagmus or something like that. And then the third part of the triad is ataxia, right? So these people have like problems with gait, problems with movement, right? But the thing is, usually people get Wernicke's first. Wernicke's is like an acute event. They get the Wernicke's first. And then after they get the Wernicke's, if it's not treated and it keeps going, they'll then go to Korsakoff's. Wernicke's is reversible. Korsakoff's is not. Korsakoff's is irreversible, right? And Korsakoff's happens when a person has amnesia. The amnesia can be anti-grade, it can be retrograde, doesn't matter, right? And then they also begin to have confabulations. So they begin to make stuff up, right? So the thing is, people that have Wernicke-Korsakoff, they have problems with like their memory sources, right? So the thing is, they may see something that is not true, or you may tell them something that is not true and they'll just agree with it, right? So those are classic ways that Wernicke-Korsakoff syndrome arises on exams, right? So the thing is, what are some things that can cause Wernicke-Korsakoff? Well, obviously the big one, right, is alcoholism, right? Alcoholism. So you may wonder, Divine, why does alcoholism cause Wernicke-Korsakoff syndrome? Well, alcoholism causes Wernicke-Korsakoff syndrome because for many reasons, right? Basically, you can maybe think of this as, okay, Divine, how does alcoholism cause a B1 deficiency? Well, let me explain. Well, the first thing is, again, alcohol directly impairs the reabsorption of vitamin B1 in the GI tract, right? Again, vitamin B1 is reabsorbed quite heavily in the GI tract, right? So the thing is, when people have, whenever people are big-time alcoholics, they're going to impair the reabsorption of B1 in the GI tract. So they're going to have a thiamine deficiency as a result of that. That's one. The other thing with alcohol is, thiamine that you reabsorb is not just the thiamine you use, right? The thing is, thiamine has to be converted to other enzymes. You know, you can, like, for it to work, for it to be a cofactor, you know, which it is for many reactions, it needs to be activated. It needs to be phosphorylated, right, into like either thiamine diphosphate or thiamine pyrophosphate. The thing is, thiamine diphosphate, thiamine pyrophosphate, the enzymes that lead to their formation, actually inhibited by alcohol. So even if you have thiamine in the body, it can't work when a person is an alcoholic, because you're killing all those enzymes that are needed for its activation, right? And then the thing is, one of the primary places where you store thiamine in the body is the liver, right? But again, we know how alcohol messes up a person's liver. Well, if you mess up a person's liver, right? Because the thing is, when a person has fatty liver, your hepatocytes, is almost like their work in life becomes to store fat, which is not their natural duty. That's the natural duty of your adipocytes, right? So if most of their life's work is now to store fat, well, they're going to have a lot of problems storing other things like thiamine, right? So those are all the different mechanisms behind an alcoholic developing thiamine deficiency, right? And when you develop thiamine deficiency, again, it's going to cause problems, right? Like, there are certain enzymes, like, if you remember pyruvate dehydrogenase, right? Remember, pyruvate dehydrogenase uses, you know, tender loving care for Nancy, you know, like thiamine, lipoic acid, coenzyme A, FADH, and NADH, right? So that thiamine is not available, right? So pyruvate dehydrogenase doesn't work. Then if you go down to the TCE cycle, right, there's this enzyme that also uses thiamine, alpha-ketoglutarate dehydrogenase. It doesn't work, right? Because, again, the person is deficient in thiamine, right? Remember, alpha-ketoglutarate dehydrogenase also uses this tender loving care for Nancy business, right? And then if you go down to the breakdown of branching amino acids, there's this enzyme known as branching keto acid dehydrogenase, right? It also uses tender loving care for Nancy. Remember, that's the enzyme that's defective in a person that has maple syrup urine disease, right? So those people, so people that have a thiamine deficiency, right? Again, they are going to have problems breaking down leucine, isoleucine, and valine, right? And then remember, an enzyme in fact, this is the rate limiting enzyme of the non-oxidative phase of the pentose phosphate pathway. Transketolase uses thiamine as a cofactor, but remember, transketolase though doesn't use every other thing in the, it doesn't use the loving care for Nancy parts. It just uses thiamine, right, as its cofactor. So you can already begin to see that there are many metabolic pathways, especially metabolic pathways that handle glucose, that will be impaired when a person has a thiamine deficiency, right? So what's the deal with that, right? So when that happens, you can already begin to see that, this is potentially a big problem, right? So this is why when a person comes into the emergency room and they're hypoglycemic, you typically want to give them IV thiamine first, at least on NBMEs, before you give glucose, right? You give them IV thiamine first before you give glucose. If you give them the glucose, then you will place more of a metabolic demand for thiamine that you're already deficient in, right? And that can begin to cause problems. That can trigger Wernicke's. That can trigger Korsakoff's, right? And again, alcoholism, right? Again, I've kind of talked about how it can cause these B1 problems, right? But remember, there are other people that can get Wernicke-Korsakoff on NBM exams. If a person's stomach has been taken out, right? If a person's stomach has been taken out, so let's say they give you a question about a person that has had a gastrectomy. Those people can also have Wernicke-Korsakoff syndrome over time, because again, thiamine is also reabsorbed in the, although this one is not as clearly elucidated, but if I'm not mistaken, thiamine is also reabsorbed in the stomach, right? So when a person has a gastrectomy, they're going to develop a thiamine deficiency, right? Or if a person has just been chronically malnourished for some reason, a person is chronically malnourished for some reason. So let's say, for example, a person has like a classic one they love these days on NBMEs is a person having what's this obigain disorder, hypermesis gravidarum. Those people, they have like a very high risk of developing Wernicke-Korsakoff syndrome, right? Or if they give you a question about like an immigrant and they tell you that, oh, this immigrant, you know, it's a lot of polished rice, right? That rice is basically not fortified. The person can, so if you see an immigrant with like Wernicke-Korsakoff syndrome and the person is not an alcoholic, it's probably from a dietary deficiency, right? Person just eating a ton of polished rice. Remember, polished rice is rice that has essentially is not fortified with thiamine, right? At least in general, polished rice is not well fortified with thiamine. So those people can develop a thiamine deficiency as a result of that, right? They can develop a thiamine deficiency as a result of that. So again, thiamine deficiency, alcoholism is a very, very, very high yield. It's a very high yield topic, right? It's a very high yield topic. So again, and we've talked about how alcohol kind of really messes up thiamine metabolism in many different ways, right? And again, as we said, when a person is an alcoholic, right? Again, they're going to have a lot of problems with energy generation, right? Because again, pyruvate is depleted. So again, things that depend on energy, depend on ATP, they don't work as well, right? And again, thiamine is a key enzyme for energy generation. We use thiamine for the pyruvate dehydrogenase complex. We use thiamine for the citric acid cycle, right? We use thiamine for the pentose phosphate pathway. So if those pathways are not working, you're going to have a lot of ATP generation problems, right? A lot of ATP generation problems. So organs that use ATP, like the brain, begin to fail. That's how people get a lot of, cerebral atrophy with alcoholism, right? But also remember, a part of the brain that is very metabolically active is the mammillary bodies, right? So those mammillary bodies, they undergo atrophy, they undergo infarction in people that have a thiamine deficiency, right? Or again, like the heart uses a ton of ATP, right? Uses a ton of ATP. If the heart is not getting able to make adequate amounts of ATP, because again, the person is an alcoholic or they have a thiamine deficiency, the heart almost develop like an ischemic cardiomyopathy, which is dilated, right? So over time, people that are alcoholics, right? People that have thiamine deficiency, B1 deficiency, they develop a dilated cardiomyopathy. Right, that's basically, and you know, when the person's heart stops working, it's a systolic heart failure from the dilated cardiomyopathy. Fluid will begin to back up in their blood vessels, right? So they'll have a lot of extravasation, right? So they become edematous, right? That's essentially why the heart failure that's associated with B1 deficiency, thiamine deficiency, is called wet beriberi on NBM exams. So again, just these are all things to keep at the back of your mind with regards to alcoholism and again this whole thiamine business. And one other thing I also want to say is remember that people that are alcoholics, they tend to have hypomagnesemia, right? They tend to have hypomagnesemia. Just in general, people that are alcoholics, they tend to be hypomagnesemic. And when they are hypomagnesemic, that can cause a lot of problems, right? Hypomagnesemia can make a person hypocalcemic, right? Because they will not respond to calcium repletion. It can also make them hypokalemic, right? And those people will not respond to potassium repletion, right? And then in addition to that, right, hypomagnesemia can cause a prolongation of the QT interval, right? It can cause a prolongation of the QT interval, right? And the thing is, even for thiamine to work, thiamine requires magnesium for appropriate function, right? So the thing is, like, it's almost like for enzymes that use thiamine inside the cell, for them to bind thiamine, magnesium is required to activate that process of thiamine binding to an enzyme that uses thiamine. So again, you can already see how an alcoholic just has many problems, right? Like, you're hypomagnesemic at baseline, you already have a thiamine deficiency, but whatever little thiamine is available, it's not even going to be able to bind to the enzymes that need it as a cofactor, right? So again, just all high-yield things to kind of keep at the back of your mind with alcoholism. So I think I've pretty much mentioned every other thing I want to say. And I guess maybe the last thing I'll say that I didn't mention, remember alcohol dehydrogenase is inhibited by fomepizole, right? So like if a person has methanol poisoning, you can give them fomepizole. It will inhibit alcohol dehydrogenase so that they don't form formic acid, which can cause formaldehyde, which can cause a lot of problems for them. So I think I'm going to go ahead and pause here. Again, this podcast is, I think as I finish it up now, I'm beginning to realize that this is probably one of the highest yield podcasts I've ever made. I would definitely encourage you to really listen to this, really know this and know this code so that you don't bungle your exams. And then, again, as I do at the end of every podcast, there is a Step 2 CK comprehensive course, Step 2 CK / Step 3. Basically, the course will be extremely helpful for anyone taking Step 2 CK or Step 3. It's coming up from the 25th to the 27th of March. Again, I don't have unlimited spaces available. So once the number of spots available is full, then the course will be closed. So if you want to sign up, just shoot me an email through the website. It's 16 and a half hours. It's 5.5 hours each day. From 11 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. Pacific time on the 25th, 26th, and 27th. So 5.5 hours each day. And we cover like neuro, ped, surgery, psych, OB-GYN, internal medicine, biostats, ethics, and all those things that the MBME introduced in November of 2020, like professionalism, communications, and all those things, right? Again, had the first iteration of the course. It's basically an expanded version of the 10-hour course. But again, the people that attended the course, that was last week, I got extremely good feedback from them. And I also have the MBME Test Taking Strategies course. That's on the 24th of March. It's for 2.5 hours. But again, we'll go through, like really, Step 2 CK, Step 3, is those are exams that depend very heavily on how good you are taking tests in addition to the knowledge you've accumulated. So most people take both courses together. They take the Test Taking Strategies course the first day, and then the next 3 days, they take the comprehensive review. Again, the review is very comprehensive. We go over like 1,100, very likely even close to 1,200 concepts over those 3 days, right? So again, it's a very high-yield course. And again, I go at a reasonable speed, so the vast majority of people are able to take pretty good notes. And then please subscribe to the podcast. So it's on Google Podcast, it's on Apple Podcast, it's on Spotify. The most recent 150 podcasts will be on those apps. If you want the earlier podcasts, then I'd encourage you to go to the website. Every podcast I've made from episode 1 all the way down is on the website. You can download it on the website. You can listen to it from the website. And the website, just in case, is divineinterventionpodcast.com. If you subscribe to that website, then whenever I make a new podcast, you'll get a notification. And then I also have a YouTube channel, Divine Intervention USMLE Podcasts and Videos. So please subscribe to that. That's where I post my videos. So again, any little bit of support helps. So thank you for listening. Please listen to this podcast, make good notes. This is gonna, I can almost promise you, this will be the source of many correct answers on your step 1, your step 2 CK, or your step 3 exams. So today I'm not going to be sharing a life lesson, but you know, I'll just encourage you. And I guess I want to reach out to those people in Texas and in parts of the country where, you know, they're kind of out of power and just had a lot of problems in recent times with the weather. Praying that, you know, God's grace be with you, and you know, God's grace is with you, and you don't suffer any losses, and you know, things come back to normal. At least that's my prayer. So thank you for listening. I'll see you next time. God bless you. Thank you.